Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities with Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. While students are enjoying their summer vacation, superintendents and principals across the state are planning for the upcoming school year, hiring new staff, making schedules, and finalizing programs. But this year, there's been a big wrench in that process. The Trump administration is holding on to nearly $7 billion in federal education funding. New York schools that were counting on that money now find themselves in a tough spot. We get more from Amy Feiereisel of the New York Public News Network.
In New York, the withheld education funding amounts to about $460 million. The programs it supports are pretty wide-ranging, everything from teacher trainings to after-school care to adult GED and literacy programs. And that money is for this school year, as in the one starting about 6 weeks from now. Tom Burns is the superintendent of the St. Lawrence Lewis BOCES, which serves 18 districts in northern New York.
These are monies that, you know, the school's expected to get. And so this was I think just out of left field, it was a complete surprise.
These weren't proposed funds. They were passed by Congress in March and signed into law by President Trump himself. So Burns says schools wrote them into their budgets, which were voted on in May.
Districts don't really know what to do here. They'll need to figure out, you know, do we run those programs?
Or do they close the programs in question and fire their staff? It's putting districts in a really tricky situation, says Cassidy Matamore, the supervisor of Title I services at the St. Lawrence Lewis BOCES. The metaphorical train has already left the station.
The budgets are already set. Players are in place. Schedules are being worked on.
While federal funds are the smallest share of a school budget, usually between 2 and 8%, depending on the district, Matamore says they are significant. She says in St. Lawrence and Lewis counties, the funds currently being withheld are used for things like literacy coaches and math tutors, social workers and counselors, and specialty courses on the high school level. She says this is a big part of how districts provide for their neediest students, and that's who she's worried about losing out.
The students that struggle, you know, they have a tough hand that they've been dealt with. Those are the students that we really try to look out for through the use of title funds.
Here's what's happening on the national level. The Trump administration says the funding is under review to make sure it is, quote, spent in accordance with the president's priorities, end quote. Democrats say withholding the money is illegal because it was already appropriated by Congress. New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand said in a press conference last week that the president is taking money from people who can't fight back.
They just want to give tax breaks to billionaires and they need to find money. And they just know that lower income, less educated, rural students don't have the political clout to push back.
An official from the Federal Office of Management and Budget has claimed that some of the withheld federal funding has been used in the past to support a, quote, radical left-wing agenda and promote illegal immigrant advocacy organizations. No specifics or examples were provided. But much of the withheld funding has nothing to do with immigrant children or services they might receive. For example, funding for teacher trainings and professional development, or Century 21 grants, a program many New York districts are using to provide after-school programming. In the Colton Pierrepont District in St. Lawrence County, that program provides 30 kids with homework support, a snack, recess time, and supervision while their parents are still at work. That's pretty critical, says James Nee, the district superintendent.
You've probably heard or run stories about our child care desert. There's very few certified daycare providers within our region.
He says if that funding stays withheld, they would be hard-pressed to continue the program.
If that went away, you know, you have 30 students and their families trying to figure out what after-school care would look like.
Nee was actually one of about 20 superintendents from New York who traveled to Washington, D.C. last week to lobby for education issues in the Capitol. Top of the list was trying to get the withheld funding released. Tom Burns, the St. Lawrence Lewis BOCES superintendent, says the nut of the issue is this. Districts have to be able to plan ahead. This action to withhold approved funding throws them into chaos.
I mean, that's been typical of this administration. You know, they seem to want to operate as disruptors. That's their prerogative. That's their choice. I think what we're used to in education is stability, you know, and we are talking about kids.
Recently, Democratic officials from 24 states and the District of Columbia sued the Trump administration for freezing the education funding. Whether that lawsuit will get money flowing before the school year begins in less than 2 months is another question mark. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Amy Feiereisel.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul is reminding school districts to submit their plans to comply with a new statewide cell phone ban in schools starting this fall. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King with more.
The legislature passed the bell-to-bell cell phone ban as part of this year's state budget. It prohibits the use of cell phones, smartwatches, tablets, and other personal devices that can connect to the internet on school grounds during school hours, including periods outside class like lunch and study hall. As per the law, schools must consult their communities and come up with their own ways to restrict and store smartphones during the day. Hochul, a Democrat, says more than 150 school districts have already submitted their plans to the state ahead of an August 1st deadline.
I'm real excited about this because we've had so many stories across the state. You know, well over a year now I've been on this journey to talk to teachers who are so frustrated that they can no longer make that connection, that human connection with a student because the student is staring at their phone all day.
New York is the most populous state in the U.S. to implement a school cell phone ban. Several districts already practice their own bans. In the weeks leading up to the deadline, Hochul has been hosting roundtables with districts across the state to discuss their ideas. In New York City, for example, public schools chancellor Melissa Aviles-Ramos says her district's plan would allow its roughly 1,800 individual schools to determine the best storage method for them. Some may use communal lockers for phones or keep them in individual locked pouches made by companies like Yonder.
Habits are built from day one, and so we are going to be ready on day one.
Hochul says simply storing students' phones in their backpacks is not a good enough plan under the law. The state is allocating $13.5 million to help schools fund cell phone storage. New York State United Teachers has its own toolkit available for districts. In addition to lockable pouches, the teachers' union approves storing students' phones in a centralized location where students can pick up their phones at the end of the day. NYSET does not recommend storing phones at the classroom level or having students keep their phones in their individual lockers, as it can potentially create more work for teachers or lead to students frequently leaving the classroom to secretly check their notifications. Hochul notes the cell phone ban is going to be an adjustment for some kids. She urges parents to use the remaining weeks of summer to prepare.
This is going to be like breaking an addiction. You know, they're used to having it with them. It's part of their security blanket. And it's someone who's addicted to cigarettes, all of a sudden you take them away that day, it's hard. So we need to start working with the parents now to help develop strategies for them to wean their children before the end of summer from this.
One concern frequently brought up by parents is how they will contact their children in an emergency. NYSET President Melinda Person says there are a lot of ways schools can keep parents in the loop. Gloversville Enlarged City School District, for example, has phones that can dial 911 in each classroom, as well as an emergency app for staff and mass alerts for parents.
What we're seeing in many districts across the state are things like adding additional landlines so that parents can call in and reach their children. We heard another district was increasing their ability to do translation when parents who do not speak English as their first language call into a school district. So districts are most definitely making changes to improve access for parents to the schools.
Hochul says the point of the law is to restrict unsanctioned cell phone use, not the use of technology, period. For example, she says a lot of schools have Chromebooks for their students, especially after the COVID-19 pandemic. She says Chromebooks can be handy for certain lessons and situations, but they should be put away when they're not actively being used for class. Person says the goal is to help students stay present and focused on learning and not on social media.
This is not about banning technology or banning connection. This is really about restoring the human connection that has been lost over the last decade or so as phones have increasingly gotten into our students' hands.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
Legislative Gazette's Jesse King with more. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with Dan Egan, the executive director of Feeding New York State. with word that food insecurity is rising. And with federal cuts to Medicaid and SNAP benefits, it's likely to get worse. Dan Egan talks about the plight of hungry New Yorkers.
Well, it's going to be very tough. So we know, and you know, this has been in the news, right? No secret, there's a brand new $3 billion hole in the New York State budget for next year. That's got to come from somewhere. And I don't envy the people who have to figure that out. And contrary to what a lot of people might think, you know, and I thought at one time in the distant past, you know, you look at the Capitol and you say, oh, man, you know, I don't know if I can trust the people who work in that building. There's a lot of great people working
there
in
are.
That building, a lot of great elected officials who supported a lot of these things you just named. It's going to be tough. It's going to take a lot of advocacy. I think, you know, essentially a defensive effort to make sure that we don't lose the gains that we've gotten over the last few years. Universal school meals was a tremendous victory, and people worked on that for a decade. We were a small part of that, but we were proud to be a part of that. We created Nourish New York, which is a $55 million program that helps us feed people using food we buy from New York farmers. So there's a lot of good that's happened, but a lot is under threat. This could be a year where advocates really need to regroup, really think hard.
And this really brings us right to that issue you brought up in the beginning, which is how much food waste there is in our society. I'm already giving myself a little punch in the shoulder to watch my meals and not leave anything on that plate. But it's so important. Your mom used to say when you were little, they're going to go hungry in other countries if you don't finish. But they're going to go hungry in the same county or on the next street or on your block.
Yes.
And the truth is we need better ways to deal with food waste.
We do. We've got some good stuff going on in New York. And I would also call your attention to California. The California Association of Food Banks is doing some great work there. But we've got a food rescue program we started about 3 years ago. We're getting a lot of food from grocery stores, bodegas, corner stores, right?
How does that work?
It's enough to restore your faith in humanity, because the way it works is you walk up, you call them or you knock on the door and you say, hi, I'm from Feeding New York, or I'm from Food Bank such and such, and will you donate your excess food? And I would say 90%+ of the time, people enthusiastically say yes. Tell me how I can help.
That's great.
Show me how to start this donation program. I want to help. Same thing with farmers. People who are in the food industry, farmers, grocery store owners, you know, corner store owners, they're in the food business. They like the food business, especially farmers. It's a way of life. It's not just a job. They want to help people. They understand that there's people who don't have enough and they want to help. They're waiting to be asked. So we ask.
No one wants to see people hungry.
Right. It's a real clash, right? So if we go back to like those myths we tell ourselves, right?
Yeah.
But the fact is that most people are really kind and good-hearted and they want to help. Right. And so we ask them and they say, sure. And then the hard part is showing up with a truck every day or every week. You know, that costs money to do. There's thousands of volunteers across the state. But fundamentally, you need to pay somebody to drive a truck. You need to get the truck. You need to put fuel in it. You know, all those things. You need to have good, clean bins and you need to train people. So there's a lot of work that goes into that. But we're doing that for about 14 cents a pound. We've rescued about 52 million pounds of food over the last 3.5 years. California's doing even better. And this is starting to take off as a concept in other states. It's not working well everywhere. So there's a bunch of academics looking at that, which is great. That's useful. But so much more could be done. That's something that New York State could do very easily. You know, the New York State budget is, I forget how many billions of dollars now, but the investment in food rescue is about $2 million a year. So if you doubled that, you know, another $2 million in the New York State budget, that's a rounding error, to beef up those efforts to put more trucks and drivers on the road, you'd get another 50 million pounds, because the amount of waste out there is just incredible. And people are willing to do the right thing and make sure that this perfectly good food you'd be proud to serve anybody in your family gets where it needs to go.
Including what you said in the beginning about the younger generation.
Mm-hmm.
Their values seem to be much stronger in terms of their willingness to support human beings with collective action on a variety of fronts.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be a good sign that in the future we may drop some of this current attitude toward each other and maybe come together.
Yeah, I think it's in our nature to come together. I I do feel lucky that I've been to so many food distributions and handed boxes of food to people and worked alongside volunteers. People love to help each other out. People want to participate in the political process. I'll tell you one quick story. I was in Queens this winter, and we were doing a food distribution. It was one of those brutally cold days we had this past winter. It was like 10 degrees. And we're down by the river in Astoria, so it was extra cold. And I got there maybe 8 in the morning. There were 200 people lined up waiting for food. During that morning, we served about 300 people. But one of the things we did is after people got their food, we asked them, these were folks working with City Harvest, one of our members, and asked people, do you want to sign a petition or call your state representative to help us do this work? And about 200 of the 300 people there that day said, oh, yeah, yes.
Dan Egan, the executive director of Feeding New York State. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New York State taxpayers will pay nearly $500,000 to settle claims from an aide to former Governor Andrew Cuomo. WNYC's John Campbell explains.
Brittany Commisso says the governor's office bounced her from position to position after she accused Cuomo of groping her 5 years ago. As part of the settlement with current Governor Kathy Hochul's office, the state will pay $450,000, which Commisso will split with her attorneys. Cuomo denies Commisso's claims, which helped force him to resign in 2021. He is now running for New York City mayor. His attorneys accused Commisso of settling to avoid testifying under oath. Another Cuomo aide, Charlotte Bennett, settled with the state for the same amount earlier this year. In Albany, I'm John Campbell for the New York Public News Network.
Summer is typically a slower time in New York State government, but this year Governor Hochul has already gathered her cabinet in Albany to discuss the effects of the new federal domestic agenda package. The Democrat warns President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill has set up a health care cliff in New York, among other impacts. Speaking with the Legislative Gazette's Andrew Waite, the New York Public News Network's Jimmy Vielkind says state officials are facing uncertainty.
State officials in New York have really focused on cuts to the Medicaid funding programs, as well as changes for eligibility for that program. So Medicaid provides health coverage for low-income and disabled New Yorkers. It's a pretty broad brush. I think about more than a third of New Yorkers receive health care coverage through the Medicaid program. Now, the federal bill does several things in how it restricts that coverage. First, there are new restrictions and limitations on coverage for non-citizens. In New York, we provide coverage for people who are green card holders, who have been in the country with some legal status but are not full citizens. The federal government is trying to dial that back, and it remains to be seen whether or not New York will continue coverage for this particular population. There are also going to be across-the-board work requirements and increased eligibility checks. Essentially, people are going to have to show that they're eligible for Medicaid once every 6 months, which is, according to experts and people who work with these programs, going to cause some level of drop-off. So all of that taken together, state officials' best estimate, means that about 1.5 million people in New York are going to lose their health insurance. So fewer people with health insurance, that's less money coming into the healthcare system. It means theoretically less medical care for these people so that when they do present, likely at a hospital, they will be sicker as opposed to in healthcare. You always want to catch conditions early. You always want to treat things early before they get further developed and potentially more costly.
So do we have an idea of the fiscal impact of that?
It's still being calculated, and it's really tough to predict because, again, you don't know how many people will fall off the rolls, what changes will happen, how other things will respond. The healthcare system, of course, though, is massive, and taking this much money out of it, there's going to be an impact. Two hospital associations in the state warned that the impact will be $8 billion just for hospitals. That doesn't take into account primary care clinics. It doesn't take into account perhaps your regular doctor's offices, some of whom see Medicaid patients. The immediate fiscal impact for the state, right? The state of New York, of course, pays a lot of money. The state's fiscal impact is going to be $750 million in this fiscal year. Now, that fiscal year ends on March 31. That means that by the next budget that New York lawmakers are going to have to put together next spring, they're going to have to fill a $3 billion hole. That, of course, though, Andrew, is just only year one. There are going to be additional impacts coming in later years that officials are still trying to figure out and assess.
So how about secondary impacts then?
Yeah, there will be plenty of those as well. So, for example, you know, 1.5 million people estimated who will lose their health insurance. What is that going to mean for their quality of life? What will it mean for their health? Will they be able to show up to work, et cetera? It's really difficult to kind of game that out. There are also millions of New Yorkers who receive SNAP benefits. And with the coming changes, it's possible that some of them will lose their assistance. Now, Governor Hochul last week was talking about this. She said that money that is given to SNAP recipients is basically immediately spent, and it's spent locally. It's spent at local stores. It's spent at grocery stores, spent at farmers markets. So that's money coming out of the economy. The other thing to think about when you think about healthcare and money coming out of the healthcare system is that in many communities, a hospital is the largest employer. That's true of where we're sitting here in Albany, where Albany Medical Center is the largest private employer in the city. So if you take money out of that system, it's likely that there will be some kind of job reductions in those institutions and therefore in your communities. Again, that estimate by the hospital associations predicted that eventually this legislation will result in 64,000 fewer jobs across the state of New York.
But New Yorkers will have some money coming back to them as part of the state budget this year, and there were rebate checks that Governor Kathy Hochul had promised. What can you tell us about the latest on that?
Yeah, Governor Hochul on Monday spoke with reporters when she was talking about a new planned ban on cell phones for students during schools. And she said, you know, look, that proposal was considered, it was debated, and it was enacted. She had initially wanted to spend $3 billion on rebate checks. It got pared back to $2 billion. And she said, look, the cost of shoes is going up for families. I know this. I just had to buy some shoes for my kids. I told them to stop growing, but I don't think they're going to listen. So Hochul said that she wants to have that money go out the door, that money was promised to New Yorkers, and that it's money that they will need to mitigate the sting of rising costs. First, because of inflation, and now, she says, some of the impacts we're starting to see of tariffs.
Yeah, and there's still more for state leaders to figure out here, right? We're expecting them back in the Capitol sometime soon. What can you tell us about the latest?
That's still a little bit TBD. Again, you know, $750 million, that's a lot to you and me. But in the grand scheme of New York State and the state budget, it's actually not that big. Remember that the New York State budget is $250 billion, billion with a B, or if you wanted to do it differently, that's a quarter trillion with a T dollars. So by kind of changing some timing of payments, dipping into reserves, yada, 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 state leaders are confident they can sort of paper over that $750 million short haul.
Got it. So how much do you think that this is a governmental story versus a political story?
Well, I think it's both, but Democrats in New York have made this very, very explicitly political. Governor Hochul last week had a cabinet meeting, and she again put the blame on Republicans. Now, of course, we have no Republicans in the upper echelons of New York's government. We have a governor, a state assembly, and a state senate that are all controlled by Democrats. But there are seven members of the House of Representatives from New York who are Republicans, and Hochul says New Yorkers should talk to them. They should ask them about their plans for the impacts.
We're taking it on the road because people need to know what we're doing and the incredible contrast between how New York State, our state government, is fighting for people and putting more money back in people's pockets, contrast to what the Republicans have done to them.
So to wit, this has already started. Governor Hochul last week traveled to Congressmember Pat Ryan's district. She rallied with him in Kingston, again, talking about the effects, talking about many of the things that we have been discussing, reductions to the healthcare system, potential reductions to SNAP benefits, the secondary effects on local economies and for New Yorkers. And we're also seeing Democrats writ large starting to pick up on this theme. Over the past weekend, two Democratic Congress members, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who comes from Queens, as well as Paul Tomko, who comes from the Mohawk Valley and represents the Capital Region, they both traveled north to Plattsburgh, which is in the district of Congressmember Elise Stefanik, to hold a town hall. They said that they wanted to talk to constituents, explain what they see as the effects and the downsides of this bill, but also to hear them. It was a pretty explicit political stunt, but one that I think is indicative of a broader strategy from the Democratic Party, which has, you know, been looking for a broader strategy and may or may not find one at some point, to put the spotlight on Republicans on this legislation and hopefully start to lay the groundwork to regain power at the federal level.
Yeah, so did we hear from Congresswoman Stefanik at all in response to that AOC and Tonko visit, or how generally are Republicans responding to this messaging?
Yeah, so Stefanik issued a statement attacking Ocasio-Cortez's visit. She called it, quote, a political gift of a radical far-left socialist visit to the North Country. It's like pouring jet fuel on Elise Stefanik's strong support in upstate New York. And Andrew, you know, this is a very red district. It is a place where Stefanik has been elected very comfortably, and there are several people who are hoping to challenge Stefanik, both Republicans and Democrats, but she is relatively politically secure. More broadly, though, when Republicans talk about the One Big Beautiful Bill, they don't talk so much about the Medicaid changes. When they do, they say that they are strengthening the program and that they're trying to root out waste, fraud, and abuse.
That's Jimmy Vielkind of the New York Public News Network speaking with the Legislative Gazette's Andrew Waite. And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2530. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York state government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.